Okay, thank you very much for the introduction. Thanks for inviting me here. Now, I should apologize to like 15 people in the audience who are hearing it for the third time. Fortunately, they are hearing it from me for the second time, some of them, but they had an opportunity to hear it somewhere else. And what I'm going to talk about is the old conjecture by Maurer, which is still unresolved. Which goes like the following. Suppose that we have a convex body in Rn, which is origin symmetric. And suppose we also have its polar body, which is just the set of all y such that xy does not exceed 1 for all x in x in k. Now I'm writing scalar product. But due to the symmetry, I can as well put the absolute value here, right? It won't change anything because if x is there, minus x is also there. Now, as almost everybody here knows, if we do some linear transformation T and apply it to K, then the polar body is just T star inverse. K, zero. What's the reason for that? The reason for that is, of course, that the scalar product xy is the same as the scalar product tx, t star inverse y, right? Okay. What does it mean? Well, it means many things, but the very first thing that comes to mind is that if you look at the volume of tk, then you get the determinant of T, in absolute value, of course, times the volume of K. If you take the volume of T star inverse K, then, of course, you get the determinant of T star inverse. And the same is true for the polar body. So if you multiply these quantities, the determinants will happily cancel out, right? Because T star doesn't change the determinant. It's the same as the determinant of T. And the determinant of the inverse matrix is one of the determinants. So what's the moral? The moral is that the so-called product volume, P of K, which is volume of K, volume of K polar, is invariant under linear transformations. Now, convex bodies, a set of convex bodies is a huge set. It's by no means compact by any standards. But the set of representatives, if you identify two bodies that differ only by a linear transformation, is compact with respect to any reasonable distance that you can do there. For example, Banach-Mazur or whatever. So any reasonable functional has maximum and minimum. And this is a reasonable functional, right? If you change the body a little bit, the functional also changes just a little bit. So Maurer asked back in 1930-something, I believe 38, but you know better, so if it's wrong, correct me. Well, what is the maximum and what's the minimum? And people figured out pretty soon what the maximum was. It's obtained on the ball or on an ellipsoid because, again, it's linear invariant. So that problem was resolved, and the conjecture was that the minimum is on the body, which is as far from the ball as possible. And what would that be? Well, in the class of symmetric bodies, from many points of view, those are either cubes or cross polytops, right? And in this case, the cube is exactly the dual of the cross polytop. So the idea would be that the minimum is obtained on the cube. So here ball. And here cube, cross polytop, whichever you like more. But that is still unresolved. So what's the value there? If you take the cube, which is the unit cube in L infinity, which means side 2, right? So one in each direction in both, one in each direction, right? Then the cross polar top is just the cross polar top given by the sum of absolute values of coordinates does not exceed 1. And you know both volumes, so here the volume would be 2 to the power n. Here the volume would be 2 to the power n over n factorial. So the conjecture is that this quantity is always at least 4 to the power n over n factorial. Now, again, I don't know how much I should talk about what's known here, because I mean, it's one of those conferences where I'm talking to the experts about such things that are knowing much more than I do. But let me just quickly list what has been proved in this direction. So some results are easy, some are not so easy. But what we know is pretty much the following. So first of all, there are some special classes of bodies for which it is known. And they are either absolutely symmetric bodies, or they are fine images, of course. What does it mean? It means that actually they depend on the absolute values of the coordinates rather than the coordinates themselves. So they are symmetric with respect to every coordinate plane. Coordinate plane. Okay, and then we also have it for zonoids. What are zonoids? Just sums of intervals, finite or infinite. So the formal definition is that you have finite sums of zonotopes, and whatever you can approximate by those is a zonoid. So in this case, it's known. What else is known? Well, Mahler proved it in dimension 2. And since then, there are many proofs in dimension 2, so if you have a student, you can give it as an exercise and see which one he invents. Okay. Now, so Mahler did it by induction, but right now you just inscribe the largest parallelogram and you are done. You know what to do next. Now, the next thing is, if you cannot prove that something is a global minimum, what do? You try to prove that it is a local minimum. Okay. So it turns out that the cube is a local minimum. Actually, a strict local minimum. In the sense that if you perturb a cube a little bit, you always get more unless you perturb it just by a linear transformation. And the same is, of course, true for the quartz polar top. Now, what should I tell here? Well, you see that you have cubes and quartz polar tops, and that's all fine, but those are not the only bodies that work like that. It turns out that you can take, for example, a product of a cube and a quartz polar top. It'll still work. And you can do a few other things. So it turns out that the minimizers are not unique in this case. And number 3 is still not very satisfactory, because we know it for one minimizer, actually for two. But I don't know whether that has been done for all minimizers by now. So Artem probably knows that. Not yet, okay. So it hasn't been done yet. That's a pity. And finally, what else can people do when they cannot prove the inequality? They prove some weaker inequality. So if you cannot find the exact minimum, let's try at least to estimate it from below. And the best estimate belongs to Bulgain and Milman. I'll tell you in which sense it is the best. So you want to put 4 to the n over n factorial. Well, you cannot do that yet, but you can put some absolute constant to the power n here. Now, you may say, okay, what would be the next step to put there like c to the power square root of n, right, or something like that? Actually, it's not. If you prove anything better, you prove the entire thing. So why is it so? Well, suppose that we have a convex body K such that P of K is at most some constant which is strictly less than 1 times what it should be in dimension n. Now what happens? What happens is that you can take the product of many copies of K. And if you look carefully at how the dual bodies depend on such thing, and if you look at the volumes, you realize that if that happens, then P of, I'll write K cross K cross K to the power M doesn't exceed C to the power M times, well, what it should be. So it turns out that if you can construct any counterexample in any dimension, you can construct an exponentially bad counterexample in high dimensions. So once you know that, you are done. So the Borghen-Wielmann theorem is the best possible theorem you can prove without proving the Marle conjecture itself. The only thing you can fight for now is that constant. Now, since Vitaly is here, I'll ask him, what was their constant in the original proof? They didn't even bother to compute it. Okay. Okay, so the original constant was something that... Okay. Okay, fine. Because to be honest, I have never tried to compute that one either. So what was there? So some unknown constant in the original proof, uncomputed. But it's effective, right? You can compute it if you really want. Okay. So now another proof is due to Cooperberg. Sorry, not how I spell him. And that's extremely good, really. So he can do pi over 4. And now there is the last proof that I'm going to present here. And the problem with that last proof is that I couldn't beat Cooperberg's constant. Actually, I did 3 times worse. So the only reason that proof exists is that it uses a completely different technique. So the rest of the talk I'll just spend explaining you how the proof works. Okay. So I'll start with reformulating this problem in terms of complex analysis of several variables. You may ask, what do analytic functions have to do with all that, right? I mean, they appear nowhere here. So let's try to consider some class of functions. So the reminder of what? Littlewood-Pelly theory. Littlewood-Pelly No, what was the class? Which one? The class of functions that are of exponential type and the integrable with square on the real line. Perry Wiener, yes. Perry was there, but not Littlewood, yes. Perry Wiener. So what's the Perry Wiener class? Well, probably it's taught in complex analysis in dimension 1, but you can do it in any dimension. So what are the functions? There are two equivalent descriptions. The first description is that we consider analytic functions in CEM, so entire functions, no singularities anywhere. Now, those functions should satisfy the condition that they are integrable over the real plane with square, and that gives you the norm after you take the square root. And they should be of exponential type, but once in one variable it's clear what it means to be of exponential type is fixed constant, because there is essentially one absolute value that is interesting. In several variables, you can define absolute value in any way you want, and that's essentially the same as to choose symmetric convex body. So we choose our body K, and we say that f of x plus iy doesn't exceed some constant that may depend on the function times e to the power, and let's see how I want it, rho k of y. So what's rho k of y? Rho k of y is just the norm. Rho k is just the norm in which k is the unit ball. Okay. So that's one description. And that doesn't seem to have anything to do with the polar body, but there is another description of exactly the same class, which is directly related to the polar body. So what is that? Well, the second description is that f of z is the integral of g of say t over k 0 of e to the power I z t dt. Okay. Where g is an L2 function. Any L2 function, no more analyticity or anything. The analyticity is in the kernel, right? So it's pretty clear that if you have this representation, you also have this. How comes? Well, first of all, on the real plane, is just the Fourier transform that is written, right? So it essentially preserves the norm, almost, right? It multiplies it by square root of 2 pi to the power n. And on the other hand, it's clear that the growth is like that. Just put the absolute value here and you are done. Okay. So the theorem, the main theorem of the Perry-Wiener theory is that those two descriptions are exactly the same. So any function that satisfies this property can be written like that. And well, the converse is actually simple. Okay. So now, what we can do is to consider one simple functional on that space. So it's a nice Hilbert, well, not Hilbert, unfortunately, it's a nice space. No, actually, it's Hilbert space, right? Because the norm is in L2. But the problem is that there is this extra condition that creates trouble with constructing functions in that space. So it's a nice Hilbert space. And we can consider the functional which maps f to its value at 0. And that's a very simple question. What's the norm of that functional? So clearly it's something, because these two conditions together allow you to estimate the norm pretty easily. But from here you can compute it exactly. So how do I know that? Well, I can write that f of 0 is just absolute value, say. It's just the absolute value of the integral of the polar, over the polar body of g of t dt. I can use the Cauchy-Schwarz inequality, and what do I get? I get square root of volume of k0 times the square, well, times just gnl2. And there is a function on which it is obtained, which is exactly the function that is the characteristic function of the polar body. So, one everywhere on the body, right? So, it turns out that the norm of this functional, let's call it, say, phi, squared, is just what? Well, it depends on how you define the norm. So if you write that integral and if you write this integral, there is a difference of factor to pi to the power n, right? Because when you take the Fourier transform without to pi here, the norm of the Fourier transform is to pi to the n times the norm, the square of the norm of the Fourier transform is to pi to the n times the square of the norm of the original function. So if I want to be careful, if I want to write it with that being the norm, I should say that it is what? 2 pi n minus n times the volume of k0. Up. So it turns out that looking at that space, you can find the volume of k0. But you don't need to find k0 itself for that. So now, how can we estimate the volume of K0 from below? Because the Mahler conjecture actually tells you to take set K and to estimate the volume of K0 from below. You can do it like that. Well, in order to do it, all you need to do is to construct a function in the space that has large value of 0 and not too large norm, right? Once you have one particular function in that space, you are done. You have some estimate. How good is depends on how ingenious you are when inventing your function, but at least some estimate will be there. So the key question now becomes to construct a function in that class with sufficiently large value at zero and not too large norm. And the problems, the interesting thing is that the problems are exactly equivalent. I didn't lose anything here. So if you can get a function with sufficiently large value at zero and not too small norm, not too large norm, then you have an estimate. And the ideal function gives you the exact equality. Okay. Now what's the problem? The problem is that nobody really knows how to construct functions in Perlewiener space when the dimension is large and the body is an arbitrary body. But since Hermander's time, actually maybe even before that, people know how to construct analytic functions with large values at some points in weighted spaces, with like in Bergman type spaces, when the norm is actually not determined like that, but the norm is determined as the integral over the entire Cn with respect to some reasonable weight. So what can you do now? Well, in principle, you may say that it doesn't really matter whether to write this inequality or whether to write a weighted inequality, if you are not after a factor that is, if you're allowed to use an exponential factor. So it turns out that you can replace this space by any reasonable weighted space that's pretty much the same, and you'll get a loss of an exponential factor. And you can choose almost any space, it will work. So what I'm going to do is to bring it to some extreme and choose some space. I mean, I tried like 3 or 4, and that was just the best that I could find. That is like the following. I'll consider the functions in the tube. So what is the tube? Well, I have Rn, and I have k here. So Rn cross k will be my tube. Now, what norm do I consider there? I'll consider the norm that is just the integral of the square with respect to the 2n-dimensional volume. So that's the standard Bergman space in that domain. And I'll write V2n to emphasize that it is 2n-dimensional volume, real 2n-dimensional volume, it's CN, right? And Vn when I need just Rn, visual Rn. So I'll call it. So again, my task would be to relate the norm of the same functional in this space to the volume of the dual set, of the dual body. So what is needed for that? Well, if you want the full story, you need the reproducing kernel and you need the value at 0, 0. But to make the long story short, I'll just tell you that in complex analysis, what the norm of that functional was known since like 60s. And the answer is this. So the norm of phi, the same phi, that maps the function to 0 squared is just, so it will be Taglia. But it's understandable. Okay. Now, so far so good. You can write anything like that, but the point is what is J of T, right? And I write it for the symmetric case because, to be honest with you, I never remember whether to put minus or plus in the exponent for the non-symmetric case. So that's the integral over k of e to the power twice x t dvn over x. So in this case, again, you can find the norm exactly. Which not again, but in this case, you can find the norm exactly. Now let's see how to relate that to the volumes in question. How to relate that to the volumes in question. So I want to estimate J of T from below, first of all. I want to show that the norm is not too large if the volume is small. Now, how do I estimate it from below? Well, here I have to integrate over K, centered at the origin. So what I'm going to do is to choose one point, say x0 in k over 2, somewhere on the boundary would be the best, right? And then I can draw half k around it. Okay. So I got something like that. And what's the point? The point is that if I integrate just over that thingy, I'll get a convex function, e to the power, what is written here is a convex function. So how can I estimate the integral over the symmetric set? I can say that it is the value at the center times the volume, right? It's at least that large. So I can continue. I can say that it is at least e to the power x0 t times the volume of twice smaller body, which is 2 to the power minus n times the volume of k. Which is nice and clean. Now, of course, for HT, I want to choose x0, for which it is the largest possible value. And since t is in the polar body, no. 2 to the power minus n, yes. Minus. Okay. Well, but half cancels with the 2. Minus n, yeah. Minus n, 1/2 to the power n, right. So the point is that I can now choose the value of x0 that now it's correct. So twice x0 is actually an arbitrary point in K, right? So I can choose twice x0 that maximizes this thingy. And what will I get? I'll get exactly the dual norm of T. That's the point. So the maximum of this is e to the power log a0 of t. Now, if I forget exponential factors that I'm not up to now, I just want to recover the original Bulgarian minimum thing, and you can lose an exponential factor at any step you want there, then I can say that the norm of phi squared doesn't exceed up to an exponential factor. What? Well, 1 over volume of k, that's definitely in the denominator, integral of over Rn of e to the power minus rho k0 of t dvn of t. And that integral can be computed exactly in the in terms of the volume of k0, right? It's going to be 1 over volume of k. Here you have actually volume of k0. And then you have what? T to the n, e to the power minus t. You integrate, you get 1 over n factorial. Sorry, not 1 over n factorial, but n factorial. Integrate t to the power and a bit n factorial. So that is what you know on one hand. On the other hand, you can try to construct some reasonable function here and plug that function, says the norm is not too small. So how to construct a function? How to construct a function? So where do people know how to construct functions? Let me show you the Hermander construction. What did he do? I'll not go over every detail, but I'll still tell you the main steps. So the main theorem of Hermander is the following. The main theorem that relates to here, of course, he has many main theorems. And it also goes back to 60s. Suppose that you have what is called a pseudo-convex domain. So omega is pseudo-convex. And you don't really want to know what it means right now. The only thing you want to know is that this is definitely one. So this cube is definitely pseudo-convex. Now suppose you have a plurisubharmonic function. Let's call it, again, I'll abuse notation, but I want to call it, okay, let's call it psi. Plurisubharmonic. And what does that mean? Well, I assume that it is nice and smooth, so then it means that the following quadratic form is positive definite, and moreover, I'll demand that it dominates the sum of squares with some reasonable constant. So that is what is called a plurisubharmonic function. You may ask why plurie and so on, and why subharmonic. Well, if you think of what happens in dimension one, then d over dz dz bar is exactly the Laplacian up to what? Up to 4 pi or something like that. 4 probably even. Okay, so it's, that's in the case when you have dimension one, you get just subharmonic functions in the usual definition. And what does that mean in many dimensions? It actually means that if you take any complex plane, one-dimensional complex plane, the function will be subharmonic there. That's what it really means. So now, what else is there for the Hermander theorem? What else is there is a differential form. So you have a 0-1 form. Which is merely the sum of, let's say, I'll call it omega j, d z j bar, from 1 to n. So those are just functions. And I want to solve the equation d bar f equals omega. What's d bar f? It is just, of course, the sum df over dzj bar, dzj bar. So f is going to be one single function and omega is going to be a form. Now, if I want something like that, at least I shouldn't have a clear contradiction with the equality of partial derivatives, right? What does it mean? Well, the assumption is that d omega is also zero. Now, I want to solve this equation, and Hermander tells me that I can do it. I can do it under what assumptions? Well, assume that omega itself belongs to the weighted space with, well, psi here, right? With the weight e to the power minus psi. So what is that? I just take the absolute value of each function, square it, and then I add them up. So the norm is here in the most trivial sense. So suppose I know that, and that's the integral over omega. Then the theorem is that I have a solution to this equation with f not much worse. Namely, there exists f such that the integral of f squared e to the power minus psi doesn't exceed 1 over tau integral of absolute value of omega squared e to the power minus psi. So it turns out that I can always solve the d bar problem if my weight is, well, roughly speaking, convex enough. So e to the power minus psi is logarithmically concave enough, let's put it this way. And I can solve it with good estimates. How does that help? So how can one now construct a function that has large value at the origin and not too large integral? So first of all, if there were no demand of analyticity, there would be no problem in constructing such a function, right? I would just take any function that is 1 at the origin, and take some descent. And if I make it very sharp, the integral of the square is completely small, right? So what would be the idea? The idea would be to take some reasonable descent and look at how non-analytic it is. And then try to correct it by something to make it analytic. So the descent I'll take, there are several possibilities, and the one I'm going to present now is not the optimal one. The descent I'm going to take is just the following. I take k cos k. I take 1/2 of it. And I'll take my function f0 that is 0 outside. this product, and it is identically 1 on 1/2 of that product. So it's a function with compact support inside the tube. Now, what else can I do? Just to make things easier, I'll assume that K is not too wild, because I can choose actually any representative in the class of bodies that are related by some linear transformation, right? And I'll use something like John's theorem or whatever to say that K is actually between some ball and what? Square root of n times that ball, right? So I'll say that my K is not too strange. So what does it mean? It means that, K contains, one of n times the unit ball, and is contained in, say, n times the unit ball. I can always do that with any convex body. Actually, the factor n here is bad. I could as well do n to the power minus 1 fourth, but I don't care. That's just John's theorem. So suppose I have something like that. Then I can create a descent like this, such that it's between 0 and 1, and moreover, its gradient is not too large. Its gradient is of order n as well. Because I have plenty of space between here and here, at least one nth in each direction, right? So I can make the gradient not greater than n. No, n, well, 2n, of course, but otherwise n. I mean, I have that much space, 1 over n, in each direction. So if I take the distance, if I take the gradient n, it already drops to 0. Problem. But you can even do n squared if you want. It doesn't change anything. So what's going to happen now? I'm going to look at this function and ask how far from analytic is it. So first of all, the integral over 0 squared is, of course, just not greater than the volume of k squared. That's obvious, right? It's a function not exceeding 1, supporting k cross k. So how far from analytic is that? Well, I can look at its d-bar, right? And d-bar does not exceed the gradient. So essentially, the norm of the d-bar, if you just integrate with respect to Lebesgue measure, is of the same size. The problem is that if I try to solve d-bar in that space with weight 1, then I have no control for the value of at 0, right? So it may happen that I try to solve d-bar, try to make it analytic, and I get just identical with 0, which is useless. So somehow I should solve d-bar without changing the value at 0. The value of 0 is, of course, 1. So to this end, I should create some funny plurisubharmonic function such that, first of all, so psi from the tube to R, and I want it to be what? I want it to be bounded. Let's see, Cn, that's one thing. And I wanted to have logarithmic singularity at the origin. How strong? I want about n log of absolute value of z near zero. And the last thing I want is that the integral of d bar f0 squared e to the power minus psi is still, again, up to an exponential factor, volume of k squared. So if I create such a function, I'm done. Why? Because I can solve the d-bar problem with the weight e to the power minus psi. But due to this inequality, it is only e to the power minus cn times worse than the usual L2 norm, in Bergmann space, right? And then I just come to here, so my total thing will be nice. Now the value at zero has to be zero for any function that is integrable with this weight. Why? Because z to the power minus, so 2n really, z to the power minus 2n is not integrable in Cn, right? So that's the smallest power for which it breaks. And therefore, if I create any function that solves the d-bar and has finite integral, the value is going to be continuous because d-bar is zero, near zero. So the function should be analytic there, then it should automatically be zero there. And then I can add this function to my f0 and I'm done. Because I get volume of k squared here, I get constant 1, so the norm of the functional is at most 1 over volume of k squared, and if you compare to that, you see that it exactly gives you the inequality that the product of volumes is at least 1 over n factorial with some exponential factor, which is exactly what I'm aiming at. So in last 5 minutes, I'll just tell you how to create this function roughly. So how to create this function? Well, here's the idea. You want the following. So first of all, let's look at this function. I'll call it phi capital. This function is just the conformal mapping from the unit strip to the disk. And if I want to be phi of z approximately z near the origin, I'll have to use the disk of radius 4 over pi. And 0 goes to 0. So I just take this conformal mapping. It can be written explicitly. But all I need to know is this. And then logarithm of any analytic function is subharmonic. Logarithm of absolute value of any analytic function is subharmonic. So most of the time it is harmonic, but at zeros you have some Laplacian, which is actually a delta measure. So now what I'm going to do is again look at this at any t in k0. And what I want to do is to look at the mapping which maps z to zt. What does it do? Well, it's a nice analytic mapping, first of all, right? From cn to c. So that is in cn, that is to c. But one nice thing is that it maps my entire tube to what? To the unit strip. Right? So for any z in the tube, the imaginary part does not exceed 1. But the real part is of course unrestricted. And 0 is mapped to 0. So now I'll define psi of z in the tube as the following. It's going to be 2n times logarithm of maximum over t in k0 and phi of zt. So also you can put the maximum anywhere you want. You can put it all the way here, right? It doesn't change anything. Now what do I claim? I claim that the composition of a subharmonic function with an analytic mapping is a purely subharmonic function. That's almost obvious from the definition I told, right? Restrictions to lines. I claim that this function is bounded. Well, apparently it is because phi is bounded, right? Never goes outside the range 4 over pi. And what I claim is that near zero, it has singularity as it should. So So it's clear because phi has the logarithmic singularity logarithm of phi, and each mapping there is essentially Lipschitz, right? So it doesn't go outside too much. So it turns out the singularity is right. You can compute it. And what is bad is that I have Fourier subharmonic function, but not yet a strictly Fourier subharmonic function. So what I want is to add something like 1 over n, maybe even 1 over n squared, y, so z is x plus iy, squared. And I'm pretty sure that on the tube it doesn't change anything, because what I added is a very, very small number. So that's how the function is constructed. Now, what's the trick? Well, you know that e to the power minus psi, so you can check all the properties that are needed for the Hermander theorem. But the trick is e to the power minus psi has still singularity at the origin, right? So if you try to integrate f0 against this function, you get infinity. Now, what saves the day? What saves the day is that d bar that we really have to integrate here doesn't have any singularity near the origin. What is more, d bar is actually 0 on 1 half k cross k. So if you run the computation, you realize that the integral here sees only the value of psi, which corresponds to the value of phi outside, like the disk of radius 1 fourth or so. So if you are outside k cross k, you'll never get close to zero here. Okay. So from the viewpoint of this debug, again, I hate to show you the exact computation, but from the viewpoint of this debug, it turns out that you don't see that singularity at all, you just see a nice bounded function. Well, bounded by n something, right? But you can use the exponential factor any way you want. And that finishes the story. So if you want more details, you have to read the paper, but the idea is, yeah, the paper is available in the following way. You can send me an email, I send you the paper. Or you can send the email to Vitaly or to many other people, so they also have it. That's another possibility, yeah. Exactly. But the key point is here. The key point is that you can create a function with a large value and small norm in this way. And it turns out that all constants. So the best constant that I could squeeze from it, as I said, is pi over 4 to cubed. Well, if you do it like I said, in a rough way, you'll squeeze like 10 or whatever, but it's also good.